Welcome to Local Exposure, a podcast about music and the greater Cincinnati scene. I'm Jim Nolan. Thanks for listening. I don't know much about Mike Montgomery's childhood, but I imagine that it included people telling him that he can't make a career out of punk rock and skateboarding. But that's pretty much exactly what he's done. Mike has taken his passion for music, recording, and skating and turned it into what may be considered a dream job. If he hasn't played with some of Greater Cincinnati's biggest and best bands, there's a good chance he's either recorded them or toured with them. In various incarnations since the 1990s, Mike has owned and operated Candyland Recording Studios, whose clientele reads like a who's who of local and regional musicians. Candyland now shares space in Dayton, Kentucky, with Christopher Mueller's Sofaburn Records in what may be the perfect marriage for recording, production, and distribution. Mike Montgomery and Katie Marks from Sofaburn Records stop by to discuss how it all got started, what's new for the studio and the label, how Sofaburn gives back to the community, and about the new coloring contest for all you record stores out there. With me today are Mike Montgomery and Katie Marks from Candyland Recording Studio and Sofaburn Records in Dayton, Kentucky. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
Mike, you've been around the local music scene for quite some time. I was wondering if you could just tell me where you started in the music world.
I started in about 1991 or 1992, I guess, playing some shows locally, just solo, and then got a band together around that same time. That band was called Thistle, and we played for about 18 years or so. And during the course of that band, I joined a band called El Gigante that was some guys that had been around longer, Jim Turner, Andy Hiddle, Pete Riley. Actually took Mike Breen from City Beat. He had moved on as bassist, so I took his slot. And at that same time, I was working at a studio in Covington called Backstage Studios, so I started recording a lot of bands. Through that, I joined a band called Ampline, which I still play in now. I also, at that place, I met some artists, Jeremy Pinnell, Cameron Cochran. They were really young at the time and did some of their first recordings there. And Jeremy and I went on to do a band called The Light Wires, and now Jeremy does a lot sort of around the world under his own name, doing kind of solo stuff with with his band.
One of the great things I think about the local music community here in Greater Cincinnati is just from listing off the names of bands and people that you've played with, you've obviously established a huge network of friends that you can then work with or collaborate with.
Yeah, I think if any artist or musician made like a family tree of people that you work or play with, it's pretty interesting how interconnected everybody is, and everybody is in each other's bands and on each other's records or helping with the art or making the videos or helping distribute it or running their own labels, that kind of thing. So you find that a lot in any kind of scene. And luckily I used to do a lot of live sound, so I would meet 2 to 4 bands every night, all the members in those bands. Sometimes I did that 7 nights a week, and then I would do the studio during the day. So just meeting a lot of energy, a lot of people making art and music. And yeah, it's been exciting to get to help people kind of fulfill their vision in the studio and doing a label and doing live shows and stuff.
And you've pretty much always done it here in at least Cincinnati or Dayton.
Yeah, I've always lived in either Northern Kentucky or Cincinnati, and this has always kind of been my scene. And I travel with some bands as a sound engineer or a tech. I started traveling in the early 90s with a band called Leap Skyward, which those guys, some people might know Bill O'Neill or Dr. Music. If you ever took an amp to get repaired, it was probably Dr. Music. So a lot of fun, wild stories with those guys because I was kind of a kid, but you know, they were nice enough to show me the ropes. And then Buffalo Killers used to take me out a lot, so got a lot more experience, you know, on a larger scale with them when they were opening for bigger bands and stuff. So
with every name and every band you mentioned, the family tree just keeps getting bigger and bigger and growing more branches.
Yeah, and then through Zach and Buffalo Killers, that's how I met the Breeders, and started playing music with Kelly, and then started working for the Breeders, and so met a lot of people through them.
That was going to be my next question, is that I know you through Thistle and Ampline, but I also know your music through your collaboration with Kelly Dio and R. Ring. How did that relationship begin?
The breeders or someone had contacted them or their camp or maybe Kelly or something about contributing a song to a Guided by Voices tribute album. And Kim was still in the Pixies at the time, either touring or working on what would have been a new album for them, maybe two albums ago or something. But the members were dispersed, I guess. Kelly decided it was a time in her life when she would start saying yes to things instead of thinking about it too much. So Buffalo Killers had already played one of the All Tomorrow's Parties festivals that Breeders had curated. So she knew they were Ohio boys and asked if they would kind of be the band for that. And they brought her to my place for what she thought, I guess, was a rehearsal and what I thought was a recording session. So while they were learning the song, I thought we were rolling. I thought I was supposed to be cutting takes. So they decided to take a break, and I just said, hey, I have that song if you want to listen to it. So they came in and listened. It was kind of like the first or second time they even made it through the song. That ended up being the take. Threw the vocal down. Andy cut a guitar solo and printed it. That was it. So yeah, just through the course of working on that, working on the mixes and stuff, she, in that old control room at that first Candyland location, I had some skateboards that friends had given me that were either liked the art or wasn't going to skate for one reason or the other, so they were hanging up. And it was coincidental that Kelly was trying to prep to go do an interview for Thrasher for her friends Christian Svitak and Mike Vallely, who were going to be in near Columbus the next day. And she saw the artwork and asked if I knew anything about skateboarding and could we prep for that. So we ended up talking about skateboarding for a few hours. And I already knew Mike Vallely because I used to write for a skateboard magazine. But then that's through Kelly is how I met Christian Svitak. We started playing together. And then this is a long-winded story. Sorry, but you did ask. So then Christian and I also play music with Mike Vallely. So I've toured kind of all over the place with those guys, which is a whole other kind of thing. Everything in my life has really been the combination of skateboarding and music. So yeah, I just turned 43 and they're still my primary interest and I'm still doing the same things kind of every day.
So then how did this all translate into the creation of Candyland?
Well, I got started recording at Backstage Studios, which was owned by a guy named Doug Staub, and Jim Turner, my bandmate, was the chief engineer there. He's the guy that hired me. And Doug sold the studio to DJ Hi-Tech. So he's from here in Cincinnati, and he bought the whole complex. And so I needed a new place to work. So Jim and I ended up, we looked for properties for about a year or so. Could never find the right space. So I ended up kind of building what was supposed to be just a temporary spot. And I stayed there for about 14 years. And during the course of that, I bought the building in Dayton, Kentucky that I'm currently working out of. So yeah, it was, how did it end up happening? I don't know. It's kind of what I wanted to do since I was a little kid. So it just seemed inevitable that I didn't have a place to work out of. So we just, you know, I just built my own place.
How'd you learn how to record? Just trial and error?
Started writing songs kind of right when I got a guitar as a little kid. And then I got a 4-track recorder when I was about 14. And I was just really interested. I would record on my boombox and then play that tape along with singing or playing live into my brother's boombox, and I would bounce back and forth like that, and that's how I would add tracks. And then when I got a 4-track, I thought, like, wow, this is magic, you know? And then came a digital recording with the Alesis ADAP machine. It was basically like a super VHS tape. You could do 8 tracks on that. You could also slave up to 16 of them together to get a higher track count. So with the invention of that digital recording device, that really opened the door to project and home studios. You no longer had to have an expensive tape machine to do multi-track recording. I mean, obviously that was the goal, is to have the nicest stuff, but you could get an Alesis ADAT for a couple $1,000s, whereas tape machines were $40,000, $50,000 to $80,000.
What was the first professional recording that you ever did?
Like, I was the engineer. That was for the local band Bitch Kicker, a 4-piece all-female punk rock band.
When was that?
Probably 96 or something.
Yeah.
They were, like, terrifying and awesome. And just, like, it was, everything was just over the top. It was a lot of sound, a lot of volume, a lot of presence. You know, I was never really recorded anyone on the clock for money. Jim Turner just kind of really threw me in the ring. You know, I was supposed to intern. He just said, you start now, just go. So just kind of like figure it out, you know.
But is this still one of your favorite recordings?
Yeah, I think so. Not because of me, just because of them. You know what I mean? If anything, I tarnished it through technical deficiencies, I'm sure, but I did my best and they did their best.
And then how did that evolve into Sofa Burn Records?
Sofa Burn is owned by a guy named Chris Mueller, and I met him by recording his band. I think at the time he was in a band called Heroes and Mad Men. And then later he joined my friend Max Fender's band Alone at 3 a.m. in just over a decade or more of recording and working for him. He had decided to try to turn his record label that had really been a vehicle for his own music into something where he put out his friend's music and kind of turn it into something bigger. And I guess he considered me trustworthy enough to employ, so he asked if I wanted to do it full time. I had been working at a local place called ICB Audio that's owned by Ian Budd, who's been kind of a mainstay in the local community as a studio designer and a systems designer. And that's what I did for full-time work in addition to running live sound in the studio. I wired recording studios and sound systems, anything from a restaurant or broadcast studio up to an arena. We kind of did any of that stuff. So I already knew how to do all that wiring kind of stuff. So I left ICB in order to do my studio full-time and work on Sofa Burn as well. So now my days are split between the two. Sofa Burn is in the same building as my studio, so I'm able to kind of bounce back and forth between the two things pretty easily.
Katie, where do you fit into all this?
Around November of last year, I responded to an ad for an intern at Sofa Burn Records, and I felt kind of weird. I was a little older, I felt, to be applying for an internship, but I'm really glad I did it. I started doing some tasks around the office for Mike and Chris, and slowly it became a position within the label. So now I'm doing global retail to various record stores, direct sales, making sure that they're getting their shipments and that they get the records that are released, and then also coming up with marketing. So we just started a coloring contest. What it is a rendering of the R-Ring cover, and when the record stores get the copy of the render, fill it in, color it however they please, post it to social media, and the winner gets a $500 prize to the charity of their choice. It has to be a 501c3. Pretty exciting stuff.
So I'm looking at the cover. It's the original cover for R-Ring's Ignite the Rest. It's just a black and white page. So you say you distribute this to your customers.
Yes.
They get to color it however they choose, and then you choose one. You just kind of pick one at random, whoever posts to, I guess, Instagram or Twitter or whatever.
Yeah, once they're posted and they're all collected, they have until September 16th to get all the entries in. Then Kelly Deal is going to take all of the entries to a docent at the Dayton Art Institute and have them select a winner. So that way it's fun and fair for everybody, and then the winner will get the donation to a charity of their choice on behalf of their record store.
Very cool. And Mike, you were telling me that this coincides with a reissue of Ignite the Rest.
Yeah, we just repressed the debut R-Ring album on red translucent vinyl, so we just thought this would be a fun way to kind of spread it around. And one of the, if you could say, goals or mission statements of Sofa Burn, something that the owner Chris is really feel strongly about, is that there's a gifting arm of the label. So he's actually created a separate thing called Sofa Gives that will serve as the gifting arm of the record label, with the ultimate goal that the label could eventually become a nonprofit or just donate everything to charity.
How recent a development is that?
It's been in the works since the inception of the label, but he just got the paperwork to delineate Sofa Gives as a separate entity from Sofa Burn. He got that all squared away this year, and we've been doing some kind of fundraising to kind of build that nest egg up a little bit, you know, and grow that. You know, we've been donating all along, sometimes under the radar, sometimes it's cash here, sometimes it's a grip of product that someone can raffle off for good, but I think he determined that he could generate a lot more money if he actually made it a real official entity and actually had a financial management company sending the donations to legitimate charities. You could actually raise more money than $50 here or there. So.
Sure. And are these usually music connected charities?
Sometimes we've so far, you know, we just sponsored the Sailor Park Sustains that Mike Oberst and the Tillers guys do. We sponsor stuff at the Dayton High School, the local high school. People hit us up all the time as a business in Dayton, Kentucky. I just got something where people are looking for money for their sports teams. It can be anything. We've donated to animal shelters. We've donated to recovery institutes for centers for addiction and recovery. It's really just anything that's a worthwhile cause, and we're really trying to grow that. So.
And you're really trying to establish yourselves as a valuable member of the community of Dayton, Kentucky.
Yeah, I think that was his whole point in starting a company, was not necessarily to, I don't want to say like that you don't want to make profit, but it wasn't solely for financial gain. It was to somehow find a way to tie it in to where there's community involvement and to give back and stuff like that. And when we can tie it in, giving back to art and music, that's the best. But anything that it seems worthwhile is on his and the label's radar.
Well then, Katie, tell me about some of the new music that's coming out on Sofa Burn Records.
We have some fun releases coming up. The ones that are the most recent, one of which is Your Heart Breaks from Seattle. Clyde Peterson fronting the band. He just released this in April. It's called Drone Butch Blues, and it is a soundtrack essentially for History of Gay Cruising. And it ties into a motion picture that he's working on called Our Forbidden Country. It's a long reading list of different books he's read throughout the years he's been alive, and writing his experience with reading it along with the actual historical value of it. So it's a very interesting album, and it's beautifully written, beautifully recorded.
So the next one slated for release that I don't have any music for you yet is Daniel Martin Moore. We'll be announcing that pretty soon and sharing some music from that. So that'll be the fourth record that we've done with Daniel on Sofa Burn.
And then I think you said you have something from Andrew Hibbard?
Right. Andrew Hibbard will be out probably this fall as well. So we're just wrapping up all of the final touches on the production of that. But yeah, he's a great emerging artist that had been on Zach Gabbard's radar for a while.
And I know you have some new recordings coming out on Candyland as well. There's a few that I'm really excited about, a new album from AM Nice and a new album from Hyperstatic.
Right, yeah. So Candyland, I luckily get to work with a lot of people. A lot of times they're local, and you know, this is referencing back to how many people you meet just by doing this for a long time. So a lot of these guys and ladies I've known over the years and all their different amalgamations of bands that they've been in, like Hyperstatic, Sammy McKee from that band, you know. He was in Charleston Entry in the early 90s. He was in Old City recently. He was in working with them. Mike Fair and his father, Mike Fair Sr., they've both been in bands forever, Pike 27. Mike Fair with Mustache Twirling Villains and his other band, The Night Divided. Everyone's in everybody else's band. So, yeah, Hyperstatic's EP just came out. And AM Nice, yeah, those guys I've all known for a while. Nick Hill, Jerry, and Adam Nice. Jerry Durr is on drums now for that band, and he runs Freightree Records, which is have countless releases from this town, and really he's got bands from, I think, even Croatia, I think, is where Joe Four is from. But yeah, Jerry's been doing it forever, so they're putting out a 7-inch.
Tell me about some of these other bands. A couple of Sarah Asher, I know just a little bit about her.
Sarah, I met pretty recently. I think she just kind of hit me up out of the blue. She was from Columbus originally, but got married, had kids, moved to a farm down in Kentucky, and she's just, her kids are kind of grown a little bit to where she's kind of back into doing music a lot more. But it was really cool meeting her, and she brought Kate Wakefield from Long in to do some cello stuff. She did a couple songs that she just put out. Long, actually, speaking of Kate, is after we finish this, I'm going back to work more on their stuff. They've got a new album they've been working on, and I've got about half of it mixed. We're kind of in the home stretch, but that's been exciting. A lot of new material from Lung on its way.
Always exciting to hear new stuff from Lung.
Yeah.
Let's see, who else do we have on the list here? Calumet?
Yeah, Calumet, another guys that have been in town forever. Aaron Cordell, he plays drums for Timmy's band, Arlo McKinley and the Lonesome Sound. So Aaron's kind of a hired gun, but he spends a lot of time with Tim Carr doing that band. Jacob Tippy, he's been an engineer around here for a long time, and mm-hmm. he had the Frankel Project for years, and this band Calumet is kind of his new thing.
And then Pine Mountain and Cult of Sorrow are two bands that I'm not as familiar with.
Pine Mountain is an extremely expansive project spearheaded by Daniel Martin Moore that involves some legendary Kentucky poets and writers and artists, and there's over 40-something tracks on it. It's a four-album set, and plus a CD, plus bonus tracks digitally, and it's all for preservation of Pine Mountain and to stop mountaintop removal in Kentucky. And he's pushing a lot for that, and all of the profits go to the Kentucky, I think it's called the Kentucky National Lands Trust Fund. And their goal is to, I think they're looking to build like a 127-mile corridor of protected land across these mountaintops to try to preserve them. So that's what that's all about.
And then Cult of Sorrow?
Cult of Sorrow is a super heavy kind of doom metal band, which is pretty cool. Somehow I've ended up doing a lot of bands in that genre. There's another band called Grey Host that just finished some tracking there with me a couple weeks ago. They're just going to overdub some vocals, and then we'll get back to mixing that one. But yeah, I really like working on music that's as heavy as all that.
What about touring? How do you support some of these bands that are on the road?
The way we support bands on the road is by reaching out to various outlets and record stores to help spread the word and information that the band is going to be on tour. That's probably, for me, one of the most important things about selling records and staying up with the bands is which ones are going on tour, which ones are traveling the most. Lung travels pretty consistently all throughout the year. The Tillers are also pretty diligent about touring. Your Heart Breaks has been playing shows around the country. So I think to get people to go see these bands is one of the most important things that I can do in my position, aside from selling records, because that's like the most important thing is putting the art in front of the world.
So it sounds like both of you, your average days are pretty busy. How do you keep it all straight?
Writing everything down. time management is a big thing. But I mean, a lot of it's kind of fueled by passion, I would say. I love doing it. I love the work. I love trying to get the Sofa Burn name out. The acts that are on it are all incredibly talented and music that I enjoy. So it's doesn't even feel like work most of the time when I'm working on this stuff.
Yeah, I feel the same way. This is what I would want to do whether I was getting paid or not. But it's just nice to finally get to do it for a job. But yeah, I mean, really with art or music or any kind of pursuit of passion like that, there's an unending amount of work that you could do all day, every day. So as far as a day really is whatever I want to make it. I mean, I could work 24 hours a day if I let myself, but I have a wife and a house and a dog, and I like skateboarding still. So, you know, set times to stop and be with my family. And but yeah, somebody always wants to record, or I always owe somebody a mix or a master, or a band needs something. So there's unending amount of work to be done all day, every day.
So if people want more information about the artists that you record, the artists that you produce, and the artists that are touring, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can go to sofaburn.com. That has a list of the artists that are touring. And then also the artist individual Facebook pages and social media outlets will have updates on their tour.
Well, Mike, Katie, thank you very much for coming in today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you, yeah.
My thanks to Mike Montgomery from Candyland Recording Studio and Katie Marks from Sofa Burn Records. For more information about the studio, the label, and the Sofa Gives project, you can find links at our website, wvxu.org/LX.
Local Exposure is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio and 91.7 WVXU. This episode was recorded and produced by me, Jim Nolan. The theme music for this episode is by Scott Holmes and comes from the Free Music Archive. You can find out more at freemusicarchive.com. Until next time.